Communication Untangled with Sue Keogh. Untangling votes.
You're in the polling booth, just you, the ballot paper, and a pencil on a string. You're hovering over the names as you decide where to put your cross. Can the design of this tiny slip of paper affect how you vote? Can you make sense of the information? Do you just go for the candidate at the top of the list whose name begins with A? In this episode, we're going to explore a small but important part of democracy, the voting slip. I'm joined by someone who cares deeply about the design of ballots. Whitney Quisenberry is the co-founder and director of the Center for Civic Design in Washington, D.C. She advises government organizations, nonprofits, and tech companies on best practice in election design. Their core principle is democracy is a design problem. Elections should work for everyone. She told me all about this when we spoke in November 2024, around the time of the big presidential election. We'll talk hanging chads, dogs in polling stations, and we also take a look at the Oscars and how members of the Academy vote for the most sought-after awards in entertainment. Back to politics, but sticking with the US, let's get started. When it comes to voting, there's an astonishing amount of obstacles to get past before Election Day itself.
Getting to vote is actually a series of micro barriers that you have to climb over. I mean, you have to know there's an election in the first place. You have to know that you're able to vote. But there are a ton of forms. The big one, of course, is voter registration. We in the U.S. put that burden on the individual. They have to actually register to vote in the place where you live, so you get the ballot that applies to where, you know, your jurisdiction. But you might have many states have an option to say vote by mail, and there's a form for that. And maybe you didn't fill in something right. There's a form for that. So there's sort of it kind of runs on this series of actions and then forms to tell people about it and then forms to fix it. And so it's full of forms and notices and signage and all of those materials. So you have to know all of those things. And we don't see people failing to vote because there's some big barrier. It's like this little series of incremental barriers. And one of the biggest might be just that in some states, the less progressive states, you might have to register 30 days before the election, right? But whereas you might really only get interested in it in that last week when everything really ramps up, and then it's too late.
And so does this have the effect of essentially suppressing votes, even though it's legal, there's nothing dodgy going on? And you could say, well, of course you should have known that you've got to vote in time. But does this have the effect of suppressing votes?
I think it does. I mean, we have historically rather low turnout compared to other countries. There is a movement in this country to have required voting the way you do in Australia. So yes, I think it does suppress the vote, and I think it suppresses the vote in low information communities more than in high information communities. We also know that voting's a habit. So if you get started, you tend to keep voting. But if we don't get you started at the beginning, if we don't invite you in a sense. And so there's some changes, like something we call automatic voter registration. A bill was passed that said that when you get your driver's license, you can also register to vote. But all it did was say, yes, please give me a form, right? So you still had to take an action. And that's being switched to say, well, when you fill out your driver's license form, you're already giving the state all the information it needs to register you to vote, and it gives them permission to register you to vote. Now, you still get a letter that says, hey, this happened. You can say, no, I don't want to be registered, or you've made a mistake, I shouldn't be registered. But it shifts the burden to the state. I have this theory, which is that a regular everyday person thinks that under the dome, you know, the capital of the state has a big dome and a wonderful legislative building, and that it's up somewhere up in their dome, there's a giant computer and everything feeds into that computer and the state knows everything. And anybody who works in civic tech or government design knows that that's really not true. But where we can say, while you're interacting with government this way, let's add another easy interaction. Let's consolidate that. Let's take the action to invite you in. Makes a difference. Oregon was the first state to do that. And several years after, they did an analysis of what percentage of people who were registered automatically actually came to vote. Now, it was still lower in the first election than the overall average, but it wasn't nothing. It was over 50%. And that's pretty good. So thinking about how government touches our lives and where we can use all of that to invite people to be part of deciding on their government.
Yeah, it's amazing how those really small design changes can have such a big impact. So just tell me a little bit more about the Centre for Civic Design. And I think the 2000 election with George W. Bush and Al Gore, which I always remember, I just think of the phrase hanging chads.
Yes.
No one in the UK is really sure what that means. But that was significant, wasn't it? And so just tell me a bit more about how the centre came to be formed and what your goals and aims were.
Sure. I mean, the funny thing about that election was that the challenge was because in Florida, they voted on something called a punch card. And that card meant that you cast your ballot on something that had no words on it at all, right? So you punched out things, you put them on a little template and you punched things out, and then they counted them like an IBM punch card, but you had no way to really check who you'd voted for. And that year, the election director in Palm Beach County, a very much a retirement community, said, "We know we have older people and that I've heard that older people's vision starts to go and they need larger text." And so she made the text larger, and that changed the design and layout of the ballot to what we call the butterfly ballot, where you had this zigzag pattern for voting. And the rest is history. And my mother said, "Is that what you do for a living?" So the light went on years after years of trying to tell her what I do for a living. Out of that came a new law called the Help America Vote Act, which was a really kind of important law and sort of reestablishing some things about elections. Out of that came a committee, an official advisory committee to set standards for voting systems, and I got nominated to it. Dana Chisnell and I had been working together. We share a mentor, and she and Ginny Reddish ended up doing a lot of research for that committee. And we kept thinking, maybe we should start an organization. Nah, it's a lot of work. And one day someone said, "You know, you guys know something. We'd really like you to do a project for us. And you're a 501c3, a nonprofit, right?" And we said, "Okay." And we raced out to get our paperwork in order. And we came out of that sudden realization at the turn of the century that you can't take democracy for granted.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the ballot itself? So in the UK, we have, say, a handful of names, and you're there in a voting booth, you've got a pencil on a bit of string. Sometimes you see the party logos, and there's a box, and you've got a cross. But I think in the US, it's a much larger affair, isn't it?
This varies, and I'll do California because they're probably the most extensive. You'll see people running for office for offices at all different levels of government. It will include federal. It will include state, like governor and, you know, the legislature in your state. It might include your county or your city and the various things in there. And it might include questions that are being posed to the voters. It could be everything from, in some states, voters have to approve major budget changes or things that are outside of the normal thing. It might be a question like whether gay marriage should be allowed or whether casinos should be allowed in your city or whether we should legalize cannabis. Right. So it ranges from things that people are really engaged in to things that are kind of more procedural.
And what are those little things that have an impact? Like, let's say a candidate, their surname begins with A and they're going to be top of the ballot. So do they have an advantage over someone whose surname begins with a W or something, for example?
Well, there's a really rich political science literature on bias in the order of the candidates. Obviously, this makes the most difference when there's not a strong leader. If there's a really strong leader, they tend to be found. But when either it's a low salience election, like nobody really knows who their dog catcher is, or it's a tight election, then that can actually show up in as something as an advantage larger than the margin of victory. So most places, well, every place has some way of deciding what the order is. It's rarely alphabetical. It might be a random draw of the candidates or of the parties. Once a couple of states do something where they do a random draw of the letters of the alphabet to create a reordered alphabet. So there's some way of deciding what's on top. In a few states, it's still the current governor's party gets the top position. So there's a bias towards incumbency. And we know there's a bias towards incumbency anyway, because it's a name you've heard before.
Let's put on our posh frocks and prepare a tearful speech as we think about a completely different contest, the Oscars. How does the voting system work here? Officially known as the Academy Awards, the Oscars are voted on by members of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, which is more than 10,000 professionals across the industry. They're grouped into 19 branches, each one focusing on a different area like acting, cinematography, costume design, that sort of thing. The branches put forward the initial nominations, casting their votes in secret online ballots with no paper used in the process. In the final round, everyone can vote in each of the 23 categories. The only one that's different is Best Picture. All members vote on this one from the outset, ranking the films from 1 to 10. And the one with more than 50% of the votes wins. Although there's no cash prize for winning at the Oscars, it can transform an actor's career and massively increase takings at the box office. There's just so much at stake, so of course the studios are going to try to influence the vote. But there are now restrictions in place to stop telephone lobbying, and while members can attend official screenings and events, film companies can't invite them to lavish dinner parties and ply them with champagne in an attempt to win their vote. The critical element is timing. You'll notice at the start of the year, there's a splurge of brilliant films all coming out at once, with big budget promotional campaigns to grab your attention. With the final round of voting taking place just a few days before the big ceremony in March, if one movie has generated a buzz, it can really impact the outcome. It's all kept extremely secret, to the point that only two people know the winners before they're announced, two partners at accounting firm PricewaterhouseCoopers. They have to memorise all the winners and hand the correct envelope to the presenters before they go on stage, which is where everything went wrong in 2017. Warren Beatty was handed the wrong envelope and announced La La Land as Best Picture, only to backtrack minutes later and explain that Moonlight had actually won. Oops! Let's go back to Whitney Quisenberry and politics. What other factors can influence the way we vote that aren't to do with the voting slip itself? The whole thing can feel quite stressful, can't it?
If you're someone with social anxiety of any sort, the sort of pressure of voting in polling place, and that's one of the reasons why people like voting by mail. There's a very interesting phenomenon, which is that if you've opted to vote by mail, but you're allowed to drop that ballot off at the polling place. In Los Angeles County, for example, 50% of the mail ballots were actually dropped off on election day, which is really interesting because it says that people both want time to think and consider, and they want to be seen in the public place of voting, but they don't want to have to stand in line. And of course, so lines are the other big deterrent. Pretty much across the country, if you are in line when the polls close, you get to vote. Someone will go stand at the end of the line and make sure no one else gets in it. But I think there's that. I think we always worry about both strong coercion or vote buying, but also lightweight coercion, the pressure to vote like the rest of your family. And the privacy of the voting booth gives you a chance to solve that problem because no one actually can know how you voted.
Yeah, there must be a lot of couples where maybe the husband is putting pressure on the wife, for example, to vote in a certain way. But then maybe just in that split second in the voting booth, she thinks, no, I'm not doing it like that.
There was actually a small campaign. I don't think it had much impact, but a small campaign this year of post-it notes in ladies' restrooms that said, no one can see how you vote. Because, you know, the question is, do people really, you know, maybe they're feeling pressure from their family, or but they have their own opinion that they've kept quiet all those years.
Can I pick up on something that you were just coming to as well, which is about the pride in being seen to be voting? So in the UK, we've got this lovely dogs at polling stations. You go along and vote, and then you might walk up there, you bring your dog with you. That's what I did last time. And then you put a picture out. It's really fun. And I think there is this kind of civic pride, isn't there?
I bet there are similar photo things that I just don't know about. But the thing where it shows up in ours is what we call an I voted sticker. So as you vote, and in fact, they're so popular that they've figured out how to include them in a vote by mail envelope as well so that you can wear it. They started actually as a sort of making all the voters be walking billboards on election day to remind everybody else to vote. But I used to work as a poll worker. And one day a woman came in with a probably 11, 12 year old child and gave her sticker. And then a few hours later, that same child came back with another adult and got another sticker. And apparently she and all the kids in her class were competing to see how many times they could go, how many relatives or friends they could go vote with and get their stickers.
Oh, that's so nice. Yeah, and definitely makes a difference, doesn't it? Just one by one, getting more people in there. And can you tell me just a little bit more about the work you've done around the design element? So let's say you've got people with access needs or people who are visually impaired, for example, or low levels of literacy. So how do you make it easier for them to vote?
Well, you start with basic design principles, to be perfectly honest. There's a beautiful piece of research that has slowly infiltrated the industry, but you make the text big enough to read, you make the spacing around it, you put the ovals in the, or the tick box in the center of the space, not the edges. You eliminate the noise, right? You can make it a nice, clean, quiet design. So you start there, and that effect, that's true for ballots, but it's true for any form, right? And then you think about words. So one of the things you have to answer in a voter registration application is what your resident, your official residence is. There's been a lot written about addresses and the challenge of addresses for people.